security flaw in Apple's iPhone allows spyware in without even a click. Meanwhile, more and more code breakers are creating more and more chaos.
There is a marketplace for former intelligence operatives to go and sell the contents of their brains to other regimes and to help those regimes leapfrog into the ability to hack.
Also today, a blow for China's Me Too movement. A court strikes down a high-profile accusation of sexual harassment, but the battle continues.
This was never really about winning or losing a lawsuit. It was always about putting up a fight.
And Angela Merkel has been Germany's chancellor for more than 15 years. The election to replace her is coming up, but it's not generating much excitement.
It feels like an election without a spark.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Tensions are rising on the Korean Peninsula. Both North and South Korea tested ballistic missiles today within hours of each other. Over the weekend, Pyongyang said that it had successfully launched a long-range cruise missile, its first test in 6 months. Soo-mi Terry is a senior fellow and the Korea chair at CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She joins us now from Seoul, South Korea. Explain the timing of these tests for both North and South Korea. Why are we seeing this spike in missile tests on the Korean Peninsula now?
The North Koreans usually greet new U.S. president with missile tests. So what was unusual is not that they conducted these tests, but they took this long to greet the Biden administration in conducting these tests. I think that had to do with the fact that North Korea had a very unusual year with the COVID pandemic. And right now they've been going through severe food crisis and economic uncertainty. Trade with China dropped to about a fifth of normal levels this year. So I think they've been distracted. And now they are returning to the regular policy of brinkmanship tactics by conducting these tests. I think they do probably want to return to talks with Washington at some point because they badly need sanctions relief.
What about the Biden administration? I mean, do you think they interpret these kind of tit-for-tat missile testing as a sort of way in to restart talks with North Korea?
Yes, the Biden administration and the North Korea team, they're used to this. There's a long pattern of North Korea returning to provocations. So for them, it took a while for North Korea to return to testing. And again, because these are short-range ballistic missile tests rather than intercontinental ballistic missile long range, I don't think they'll be alarmed, but they will see it as a sign, I think, that Kim wants to return to talks. And again, this is a move to pressure Washington to sort of remind the Biden administration saying, hey, we're still here. Don't ignore us. We're still working on our nuclear missile program.
What advice would you give the Biden administration in terms of how to restart talks with North Korea?
Well, that's a tricky thing because what the North wants is a guarantee that there will be a significant sanctions relief and that there will be a departure from what happened from the Hanoi summit when the talks failed and they didn't get any kind of sanctions relief. So they would want some sort of assurance from the Biden administration that they will give something. But the Biden administration is not interested in giving premature sanctions relief. So they are stuck. I would say for now, I agree that you cannot give premature sanctions relief. So you just stay calm and carry on. We know this is a tactic by North Korea to increase pressure on Washington. So until North Korea is also serious about making progress on the denuclearization front, I don't think we should be too rattled.
So just kind of hang in there. It just seems like this has gone on for decades. I mean, you just live with it?
Well, I'm sorry, but there is a reason why it went on for decades. There is no solution to this. I mean, what other solution can one suggest? Should we give premature sanctions relief to just bring North Korea to negotiating table? And then what? It's very unsatisfying, but there is a reason why this crisis has been going on since early 1990s. We went through the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, the Obama administration, and President Trump. President Trump has even met with Kim Jong-un 3 times, and this is where we are. I mean, it's very unsatisfying, but there's no easy solution when it comes to North Korea, and that's just a fact.
Okay, here's my final question. What should the U.S. goal be with North Korea in terms of its nuclear program?
I think the U.S. goal should be to manage the crisis it's unrealistic to think that we're going to achieve denuclearization under this regime. I'm not saying we should give up denuclearization as a goal. At least rhetorically, we cannot do that because it would have, that would have consequences of its own. But it's to manage the crisis. And I do think the long-term solution is to get information into North Korea, is to help the people of North Korea, because the only way North Korean crisis or any kind of change will come about is if people of North Korea bring about the change. Denuclearization is not a realistic goal under this regime, under the Kim family, Kim dynasty.
Sumi Terry is a senior fellow and the Korea chair at CSIS, the Center for Strategic International Studies. She joined us from Seoul, South Korea, to talk about recent tensions and missile tests on the Korean Peninsula. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
When Belarus's President Alexander Lukashenko claimed his sixth election victory 13 months ago, protesters quickly flooded the streets. They, as well as most Western countries, called the vote a sham. The Belarusian government cracked down hard, and many dissidents fled to neighboring Lithuania. They were given humanitarian protection there. But as Andrew Connolly reports from Lithuania's capital, Vilnius, it hasn't necessarily given them peace of mind.
A small group of protesters are gathered outside the Belarusian embassy in Vilnius. They're draped in red and white flags, chanting against the dictator back home, Alexander Lukashenko. Passing drivers honk their horns in support. Back in Belarusian capital Minsk, a prominent opposition figure has just been sentenced to 11 years in jail. One of the demonstrators tells me it's the dystopian reality of Belarus, where thousands of cases have been fabricated.
As we often say, George Orwell is turning in his grave.
Tatiana Inatieva fled to Lithuania in October. She tells me that she too was the target of a criminal investigation after she collected signatures for the opposition movement.
It's not that we can influence the situation on the side of the authorities, but we do express our solidarity, and we do. I know my friends from Belarus always tell me that it's very important because they can see that nothing is forgotten and nothing is going to be forgotten.
In the last year, the Lithuanian capital has become a hub for Belarusian opposition. Leading presidential candidate Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who recently met with President Biden at the White House, is based here. Vyacheslav Zhukov works for the Strana Fund. It helps train activists to organize inside Belarus. He has refugee status here in Lithuania, but he's still wary of being targeted by Lukashenko's government.
Actually, when I see a car with Belarusian numbers, I'm opening Telegram channels, the Black Book of Belarus.
Telegram is a secure messaging service that opposition figures use to share information, like license plate numbers, for people who might be looking to do them harm.
Judges like policemen, KGB agents and other stuff, and I'm trying to find these numbers, and if it's okay, is it empty, I go, okay, maybe his friend, I don't know. But this is the first thing I'm doing in this situation.
In August, police in Ukraine launched a murder inquiry after the head of a Belarusian human rights organization was found hanged in a park in the capital, Kiev. It spread fear among exiled Belarusians. It also raises questions for the governments hosting them.
Beyond responsibility for the people, there is also a sense of danger.
Lithuanian Foreign Minister Gabrielis Landsbergis says that his government's hosting of the Belarusian opposition, as well as lobbying for sanctions, has brought it into direct confrontation with Minsk. When we speak in early September, Belarus and Russia are conducting large-scale joint military exercises across the border. But Landsbergis says Lithuania will continue to give sanctuary to Belarusians escaping persecution.
How do they get here?
We still receive them. It's much more difficult now since we were forced to reduce our embassy staff to, I think, one or two people in Minsk. That means that it's much more difficult now to apply for a humanitarian visa because it takes much more time and so on and other things. To add to that, it's much more difficult to leave the country because border control is much stricter. Lukashenko is not allowing many people out, but people still do get out. and we still do accept them, and we will carry on doing that.
Dissidents have been given fast-track visas or allowed to enter at border checkpoints, but some targeted by Lukashenko's government have been forced to escape Belarus through the forests and into Lithuania without documents. Andrei Strizhak has been helping them to make the journey.
For Americans, more understandable, it's like underground railway.
But just as he helps Belarusian activists to escape over the border to Lithuania, Strizhak worries that Lukashenko's security forces could also enter.
Belarusian government every time said that we catch you, we are going through border in a field or in a forest, and nobody can say feeling self safe.
Strizhak says he doesn't feel safe here at all. As head of the Belarusian Solidarity Foundation, he has raised millions in donations for Belarusians who were fired for political activism and the families of political prisoners, all channeled through cryptocurrencies to avoid interception by Lukashenko's government. But Strizhak goes on to say that sometimes he feels conflicted.
When all going out from country, who build a country? Who will to resist them? Who will something to change? I very hope that people who now going out and building their life here, in a 10-20 years, he have money, have knowledge, have skills, which they can to import to Belarus.
Belarus is isolated by the West, but Russian President Vladimir Putin has promised hundreds of millions of dollars in loans, cheap gas and military hardware. After months of brutal crackdown, the streets of Belarus are mostly silent now. And Andrei Strizhak says people are traumatized.
For me, it's easier because I every day know what I must do. I must just don't stop my work.
It's easy to get depressed about the situation back home in Belarus, but Strizhak says these days he just doesn't have time for depression. For The World, I'm Andrew Connolly, Vilnius, Lithuania.
The internet is flooded today with images and videos of a massive dolphin hunt in the Faroe Islands. That's a semi-independent Danish territory located between Scotland and Iceland. As The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports, activists made the recordings in an ongoing effort to curb the annual tradition.
The footage the environmental group put out shows dolphins thrashing around in the water. The water is turning red with blood. The hunters line the carcasses up on the beach, and hundreds of people gather to watch. This dolphin hunt is a cultural tradition called the Grind. It's been around for 1,000 years, brought over by the Vikings from Norway to the Faroes. Nowadays, hunters use speedboats and jet skis to corral the animals into shallow waters where they can be killed. The Faroese government says usually around 20 or 30 dolphins are caught every year, but this time it's estimated that almost 1,500 were killed.
They don't normally take that many.
Oliver Schurebeg, the chairman of the Faroese Whalers Association, told the BBC the hunters made a mistake. They underestimated the size of the pod of dolphins and only realized what was going on when they started killing. He said people are shocked and angry.
We have to look after what went wrong, did anything go wrong, and what can we do to avoid it in future.
Dolphin hunting is legal in the Faroe Islands, and this species of dolphin, the white-sided dolphin, is not endangered. But conservationists from the group Sea Shepherd, the group that distributed the footage, says the practice amounts to brutal slaying. The group calls the campaign Operation Bloody Fjords and has been campaigning to end the Grind since the 1980s. They say the hunts rarely go as planned, and they can turn into, quote, drawn-out, often disorganized massacres. What happened on Sunday, they say, is case in point. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. More political drama in Haiti. The government there has now banned its own prime minister, Ariel Henry, from leaving the country. That's because Haiti's chief prosecutor wants to question Henry about the July assassination of President Jovenel Moise. Phone records show a key suspect in the assassination called Henry twice just hours after the killing. Henry has tried to sack the prosecutor investigating him and calls the travel ban illegal and political theater. Widlor Marincourt in Port-au-Prince has been following the twists and turns in the murder investigation. He's the editor of the Haitian news outlet Aibo Post. Widlor, the investigation into the killing of Haiti's president has now gone all the way to the top of the government. What is the latest evidence that seems to implicate Prime Minister Henri?
The most important human rights organizations in Haiti, RNDDH, put out a report that says that the actual prime minister, Mr. Ariel Henry, had different phone calls with Abadiou, who is one of the alleged assassins of the president. There is a power struggle at the top of the government, and there is different factions fighting for the future of the country.
Can Prime Minister Henri fire the prosecutor investigating him? Is that legal?
It's unclear if it's legal, but what we do know is it's effective, right? The Prime Minister fired Bedford Claude, who was on the president's assassination case, although the case was not with him anymore because he sent it to an investigative judge. This judge is Gary Aurelien, so that's why he requested to this judge to add the name of the Prime Minister and indict him in this case. So he is replaced by someone else, and this person is telling the press that it's up to the judge investigating the case to decide whether he will indict the Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, or not.
It's been 2 months since gunmen broke into the home of Haiti's president and murdered him, and some of those who collected evidence in the case have gone into hiding. Do Haitians think investigators are getting any closer to understanding who ordered and paid for the president's killing?
I don't think so. And I think it's extraordinary that 2 months after the assassination of the president on 7th of July, we don't know more about who ordered the killing. About 40 people are in custody right now with the authorities. But at the same time, the key details regarding who is behind it, we don't know more.
Nationwide elections were planned for Haiti this year, but since President Moïse's assassination last July, Haiti's been struck by an earthquake and a devastating storm. When might these elections happen?
The international community is pushing so we can have election as soon as possible. But a lot of people will tell you that we are not ready to have election. We were not ready before the earthquake. We were not ready before the storm. We were not ready before the assassination of the president. And now we have an insecurity climate that is rising. You have different major cases of kidnappings in this country. And on top of that, you have food insecurity and the needs of people in the south. It's very difficult for us to make sure that we have the system in place so we can have elections.
Widlor Marincourt is the editor of the Haitian news outlet Aibo Post. He's been speaking with us from Port-au-Prince about ongoing investigations into the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse. Thanks, Widlor.
Thank you.
After the new Texas law went into effect that bans most abortions after 6 weeks, some women there have begun to look for other ways to access abortions, like traveling to other states or going to online platforms that sell pills that induce abortions up to 10 weeks into pregnancy. These sites are popular in countries where abortion is illegal or hard to access. The World's Lucia Benavides has reported on abortion access in various countries and joins us now from Barcelona. Lucia, can you tell us, what does it mean to order abortion pills online? I mean, what does that look like?
So in places where abortion is legal, you can actually go to the doctor to get these pills prescribed. But there are many websites selling abortion pills for people to take at home without needing to go to a clinic. You visit their website, go through a medical consultation, order the pills, and then receive them in the mail some days later. Usually that applies to people living in countries where abortion is illegal or in rural areas where abortion services are difficult to access. For example, they're used a lot in Poland, Malta, various Latin American countries. And the pills are sold through nonprofit organizations like Aid Access, Women on Web, Women Help Women. But the U.S.-based organization Aid Access has told other media outlets that they've noticed an increase in requests since the law in Texas passed, banning most abortions past 6 weeks.
And just to be clear, these are just basic pills. You take them orally, you swallow them, and then what happens?
Yeah, so there's two pills, mifepristone and misoprostol. So when taken together, they trigger a miscarriage. And you can only take them when you're early in the pregnancy. It's usually recommended for patients fewer than 10 weeks pregnant.
Are these pills designed to terminate a pregnancy, or are they pills that are intended for something else, but that's one effect of them, and so that's why people are ordering them?
Yeah, so both mifepristone and misoprostol are FDA approved and are actually the recommended medication by the World Health Organization to induce abortions. But they were initially, or one of them was initially used for stomach ulcers. This all started actually in Brazil when abortion was completely illegal. It still is. Marge Barra, who is a coordinator of the International Campaign for Women's Right to Safe Abortion, said that in the 1980s, women there figured out that the stomach ulcer drug mifepristone has a huge warning about miscarriage.
The drug company that invented mifepristone put that together by the early 1990s. And then they developed the first pill packet.
The drug company that owns mifepristone eventually added the second pill to be taken kind of as a package together. And that's when they were sold as an abortion pill. And Barra says that it's helped make abortion access safer, especially for those in clandestine situations that would have otherwise opted for more dangerous methods.
The death rate from abortion internationally has dropped substantially, and the rate of serious complications have dropped even more substantially because of medical abortion pills.
During the height of the pandemic last year, healthcare providers in some countries began offering the option of shipping abortion pills through the mail so patients didn't have to visit the hospital or the clinic. And lawyer Ainsane Marquez from the organization Women's Link Worldwide says she hopes that that's the future of abortion care services.
Studies show it's completely safe through telemedicine. So the laws should adapt to these practices, and that is what we stand for.
Lucia, how are people opposed to abortion dealing with pills that induce abortion? How are they trying to combat it?
So anti-abortion organizations across the world have been trying to get these websites either censored or make it a crime to order pills online. And actually, the Texas legislature has advanced a bill that would make it a criminal offense to mail abortion pills in Texas. And they also want to decrease the legal time frame for abortion pill usage from 10 weeks to 7 weeks.
The World's Lucia Benavides in Spain. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Norway is racing to become a world leader on fighting climate change while still getting rich by exporting lots of oil. Some political candidates label that hypocrisy.
If you want to invest in renewable, you have to invest in renewable and not investing in more oil. We don't have time for that.
That's just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. A massive security flaw was discovered in Apple's iPhone this week, and it's a biggie. The phones could be broken into without the user doing anything to trigger the hack. Without even a click, your information could be at risk. That news left iPhone users scrambling to update their devices. It was security researchers at the University of Toronto's Citizen Lab who realized that spyware from an Israeli cyber surveillance company was behind it. John Scott Railton and his colleagues discovered the breach on a Saudi activist's phone. He's a senior researcher with Citizen Lab in Canada. John, how exactly did you and Citizen Lab discover the vulnerability in the iPhone software?
So we were looking at the telephone of a Saudi activist, and that phone was infected with a sophisticated piece of spyware. The spyware was made by an Israeli cybersecurity firm and mercenary hacking company called NSO Group. And NSO Group claims that it sells spyware to governments so that they can track criminals. However, for the past 5 years, their spyware keeps showing up in cases where activists, journalists, and human rights defenders are being hacked.
Were you able to figure out who had used that spyware? Had a government bought it, like the Saudi government?
So at this time, we're not attributing the spyware to a particular NSO customer. What happened last week is that we were examining a backup that we had collected back in March of this activist's phone. We discovered some suspicious files, and it turned out that those files, although they appeared to be GIFs, were actually malware and exploit payload. And what they would do is turn that phone into a spy in the activist's pocket. As soon as we spotted those files, we had a sense that we knew what we were looking at. We then shared them with Apple. And in less than a week, Apple moved to quickly figure out the vulnerability and push out an update to all Apple devices.
Will you eventually be able to figure out who was behind putting that in the Saudi activist's phone?
One of the things that's important to realize here is that this is a spyware and an industry that is built around concealing itself from attribution and, as a result, hiding from accountability. And it's cases like this that highlight both how seriously companies like Apple take the threat to their bottom line, but also the extent to which the industry needs to be exposed and needs to be called out and needs to be responded to. Now, some people have said, well, should I be concerned? I'm not a dissident. I've never criticized an autocrat. And the truth is, with respect to exploits, they may be used by a small number of people in the first year. But after that, who knows? Exploits have a bad habit of being used by an ever-widening circle of bad actors until they're being used by cyber criminal groups to target people just like you or me.
Now, has Apple's response been effective? Has what they issued for people to fix this really worked?
So Apple has moved quickly to close the specific exploit that NSO was using in this case. But the spyware industry is built around always having some exploits in reserve. And so while this particular technique for gaining access to people's phones is gone, NSO itself remains a serious threat to phone users.
Will NSO Group suffer any penalties?
NSO is certainly forging ahead to make more spyware. They are doing their best to hire former administration officials in the U.S. and otherwise slosh their money around in an effort to keep their business going and growing. It's pretty clear that the tech sector is fed up with NSO Group at this point. And I think a lot of people are now looking to government for some kind of help. And it's an interesting coincidence that yesterday, in an indictment the Department of Justice released against three Americans, former intelligence community members helping the UAE government build hacking capabilities, the Department of Justice explicitly called out the international spyware marketplace and pointed out that that unregulated marketplace is causing global harm.
That's an interesting case about these three former intelligence and military officials. How did that case move to a point where they could be charged?
Well, this is a really interesting case. So a couple of years ago, Reuters reported on the existence of something called Project Raven, which in a nutshell was a group of former U.S. intelligence and military officials who had gone to the United Arab Emirates and were helping them stand up a hacking capability. At the time, it was a scandal, but it pointed to something deeper, which is there is a marketplace for former intelligence operatives to go and sell the contents of their brains to other regimes and to help those regimes leapfrog into the ability to hack at a nation state level. This was obviously a really concerning case, and if you read the charge documents, it seems pretty clear that what was going on is these people were giving the UAE things that they had learned and things which the U.S. government alleges were protected by export regulations. What's interesting about that case is that it is the tip of the iceberg in terms of the marketplace of former officials turning around and monetizing the knowledge that they gained protecting the U.S. The harm that those people are causing is very concrete. In the case of Project Raven, the targets included activists and dissidents, but also U.S. citizens.
And John, my final question has to be, you know, there's about a billion plus people with iPhones. Should all of us go and find the update?
Everyone should update. You may not think of yourself as the kind of person that an autocrat is going to be interested in. Think about what you're doing as increasing our group immunity against shady companies like NSO Group.
John Scott Railton is a senior researcher with Citizen Lab, an interdisciplinary laboratory focused on cybersecurity and human rights. It's based in Canada. He helped uncover the recent hack of Apple's iPhone. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you so much.
It's the end of an era in Germany this month as Chancellor Angela Merkel steps down. She took the helm 16 years ago. German elections take place on the 26th of September, and right now, polls suggest that the future leader may not be the person Merkel would have wanted. Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry has more.
Is this the most boring election ever? That's an actual recent headline in one of the big German newspapers. And it's not just the campaign that's been a bit lackluster. The candidates don't seem to be firing up German voters either.
It feels like an election without a spark.
John Worth is based in Berlin and teaches European politics at the College of Europe. He says the most fascinating part of this election is that it's still all too close to call. There are three contenders vying for Angela Merkel's job. Armin Laschet is with the centre-right Christian Democrats. He's known as Mr. Nice Guy. Olaf Scholz is from the Social Democratic Party on the centre-left. A former US ambassador to Germany once said that Scholz makes watching water boil seem exciting. And probably the most dynamic of the three is Green Party candidate Annalena Baerbock. Up until this summer, the election was Armin Laschet's to lose. But then catastrophic floods struck Germany.
The police have said that up to 90 people have been confirmed dead in the Ahrweiler region. That is
overall, more than 180 people lost their lives. One of the worst hit regions was North Rhine-Westphalia, where Armin Laschet is state premier. Opponents had already slammed Laschet for his half-hearted approach to climate issues. Then a video went viral of the German president Frank-Walter Steinmeier appearing at a news conference in a flood-stricken town. As a somber Steinmeier tells reporters about the planned relief effort, Armin Laschet can be seen in the background, laughing and joking. Many Germans were furious. Laschet issued an apology, but John Worth says the damage was done.
And that just sort of showed a politician who's not always really thought of to be necessarily serious. And that was the point at which the polling numbers started to go down for the Christian Democrats.
It wasn't the only blunder during the campaign. Annalena Baerbock, the Green Party candidate, was accused of embellishing her CV and plagiarising passages in her new book. Social Democrat Olaf Scholz has avoided making any big gaffes, and he's now the front runner in the polls. Climate change has been a big issue on this campaign trail, but for the last 5 years, migration was one of the burning issues in Germany, and it's one the far-right AfD party has used to win votes. Now, with the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, the AfD says there's a new wave of migrants on their way.
Sie wollen die Schleusen aufmachen. Sie sagen hier groß 2015 soll ich wiederholen. Sie schaffen die Voraussetzungen.
That's Armin Paul Hampel, the party's foreign policy spokesman, speaking in Parliament. He said this German government wants to open the gates and let migrants in. Wiebke Judith is with ProAsyl, a refugee rights group based in Frankfurt. She says this kind of scaremongering is not resonating with voters.
It does seem like AfD has not really a lot of traction at the moment during the campaign. They have tried to use the issue of evacuations from Afghanistan, but fortunately they have not managed this time to spread the false messages in a huge way.
Most of the other candidates have adopted a cautious approach to the idea of accepting Afghan refugees. Here's Armin Laschet speaking to reporters just days after Kabul fell to the Taliban.
Wir müssen diesmal rechtzeitig in der Region, in den Herkunftsländern.
This time, Laschet said, we need to provide humanitarian aid in the countries of origin. 2015 must not be repeated, he said. Olaf Scholz, the Social Democratic Party candidate, said nearby Pakistan, Iran and Turkey should take in most Afghan refugees. Saeed Hamiyoun Saudut says Germany has a responsibility to help the people of Afghanistan. He lives in Leipzig with his wife and son, but the rest of his family are still back home in Afghanistan. Saudut worked as a translator and cultural advisor to German troops in Afghanistan for 5 years. He tells me he gets daily calls from Afghans looking for help to flee the country.
Colleagues from school, university, from sport, a lot of they give a call me, send me a message, how to come to outside of Afghanistan.
Saudut hopes that Annalena Baerbock, the Green Party candidate, will be the next chancellor. She says Germany should take in at least 50,000 Afghan refugees. Right now, though, Baerbock is a long shot for the top job. Whoever wins, foreign policy experts say Angela Merkel will be a tough act to follow. Claudia Mayor is with the German Institute for International and Security Affairs.
She had a way of just remaining calm and dealing with the most difficult interlocutors like Putin or Trump or Erdogan, and she stayed amazingly calm and she steered Europe and Germany through many crises.
Laschet and Schulz are both selling themselves as continuity candidates, ready to uphold Merkel's legacy. But whoever wins, Claudia Mayor predicts some changes ahead.
We will probably see a slightly different approach to the transatlantic relationship, maybe a bit more distanced.
The election is on September 26th, and it's likely to take a few months for the winners to form a new government. One thing is certain, though, after 16 years, the woman many Germans still call Mutti will no longer be in charge. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
In Germany, climate change is growing ever more important as an election issue, also in other parts of Europe. It was center stage for voters in Norway this week, a country that lives inside a bit of a climate contradiction. Norway has pledged to contribute no additional greenhouse gases to the atmosphere by the end of the decade, aka becoming carbon neutral. But Norway is a leading producer and exporter of oil and all the carbon emissions that go along with it. Brett Simpson reports on what net zero actually looks like on the ground in Norway, and how attitudes about oil played out in this week's parliamentary election.
Walking down the streets of Oslo, Norway feels like walking into a low-emissions future. Electric trams and buses zip alongside generous bike lanes and around parks designed to store carbon. But the real evidence of the city's low carbon footprint is actually underground, in a vast network of tunnels housing its power lines.
We're 40 meters below Oslo, where the tunnel is now transporting power to distribute in Oslo.
Henrik Glette is with Statnett, Norway's state-run electricity provider. Once, he could have shown me the power lines we're looking at alongside any major road. But lately, the demand for new connections have grown so much, they've run out of space above ground. And they're taking them subterranean.
We have invested now in one tunnel, we're busy building a second one to reinforce the grid in Oslo for what we know is coming.
What's coming is a move to electrify everything so it can be powered by renewable energy. As Oslo races to hit net zero emissions by 2030, manufacturing, port operations, and construction are all moving off of fossil fuels. And things are getting eerily quiet.
So as you can hear, it's no noise.
That's very, very quiet for construction, huh?
Yeah, it is.
That is the sound of construction happening with battery-powered excavators and diggers. Sjur Helgesen is with Nasta, the company that makes these construction vehicles. In 2018, Oslo decided that all new public construction projects must be zero emissions. And Helgesen says that supercharged their development.
2 years ago, these machines that you have seen today, they didn't exist.
Just a few miles away along the coast, Heidi Nielsen shows me another fully electric fleet in operation.
So now we have somewhere in between 70 and 100 electric ferries all along the Norwegian coast because the government had a procurement strategy.
Nielsen's with the Oslo port. She says they've electrified their equipment too and installed electrical hookups so ships can turn off their diesel engines when they're in the port. She points to a big blue crane on the shore.
The great crane with the seagull on top?
Yes.
Yeah, that's shore power.
All across Norway, these changes are gathering momentum. But there's a huge contradiction hanging over the country's plan to reach net zero emissions by the end of the decade. Norway's biggest export is oil. In 2020, Norway exported about 415 million barrels of oil. Burning that would emit 30 times the greenhouse gases than Norway's population does each year. And the country is still approving new oil wells. To many Norwegians, this contradiction is becoming untenable. It was a key issue in this week's national parliamentary election.
It's definitely hypocritical.
That's Arild Hernstad, the deputy leader of Norway's Green Party, which helped put the country's oil policy on the agenda for Monday's election.
If you want to invest in renewable, you have to invest in renewable and not investing in more oil in order to do some transition in the future, because we don't have time for that.
The Green Party campaigned on a platform of ending all oil drilling by 2035, hoping to win enough seats to be represented in Parliament for the first time.
If everyone here live in a zero-emission city and at the same time work in the oil industry and export a lot of CO2, that's kind of ridiculous.
But not to the two biggest parties in Norway. Benjamin Jacobsen is a Labour politician who stressed that it's a jobs issue.
Norway has a moral dilemma, of course, but we can't really risk 200,000 people their jobs because that will harm the economy and we won't be able to reach our climate goals if people are unemployed.
On Monday's nationwide election, this perspective won out. The Labour Party claimed the majority as expected, which means no end date on oil drilling. The Greens did worse than expected and didn't win enough votes for a seat in Parliament. Analysts say it was a loss for the Greens, but they still have momentum.
I would actually say that the political winds in Norway are blowing towards the Green Party.
Johannes Berg studies elections with Norway's Institute for Social Research. He says that this year, other issues like social inequality and the pandemic probably took center stage. But in the long term, as younger generations make up more of the electorate, climate issues will win out.
They are obviously the voters of tomorrow, and that generation will certainly influence Norwegian politics for the years to come.
Until then, it seems, Norwegians will keep living with the contradictions. And by 2030, they might just be a country that calls itself carbon neutral, but still exports a million barrels of oil a day. For The World, Brett Simpson, Norway.
A court in Beijing has dismissed a high-profile case of sexual harassment. A former television intern, Zhou Xiaoxian, known by her nickname Xianza, sued her co-worker, a television star. She said he assaulted her in a dressing room 4 years ago. But the court has ruled against Xianza, a blow for China's Me Too movement, one that's been both growing among young people in China and slapped down by the Chinese government. Joining us now to discuss all of this is Leita Hong Fincher. She's the author of a book about feminism in China called Betraying Big Brother. Later, the Beijing court ruled that Xianza did not produce sufficient evidence in her harassment case. What do you make of that ruling?
Well, I'm not really surprised by the ruling at all. I think a lot of people are not surprised. This was never really about winning or losing a lawsuit. It was always about putting up a fight. And China doesn't truly have rule of law. And also Xianza, her own social media account on Weibo has been blocked in an ongoing crackdown on feminism. So I see this result as, I mean, it's sad, but it doesn't mean the end of the Me Too movement in China.
We're talking about this case and talking to you about it, but inside of China, did this case get much attention?
Well, it didn't get a lot of attention from the state media. Where it got a lot of traction was in the women's and feminist community through social media like Weibo and WeChat. The case has been widely watched outside China more than on the inside. You have to understand that China doesn't have true internet freedom and it doesn't have press freedom. So the Chinese government's been cracking down a lot on feminist social media accounts recently, and the feminist movement is very beleaguered. So Xianza's case has sort of galvanized the feminist community and brought in more supporters to an ongoing movement that's been going on for quite a few years, and I would expect it to continue even in the face of this strong crackdown.
Now, the accused in this case is a well-known TV personality on state-run TV. How do you think that affected the way the Chinese media handled the story?
Well, I think that's incredibly important because the host was working for state television. If you look at another recent high-profile case, there was a woman who accused a very famous pop star named Chris Wu with rape. He's actually been arrested, and that was actually covered by Chinese state media, but he didn't represent the government.
You mentioned Chris Wu and that he's been charged. What history is there to the success of sexual harassment lawsuits?
The courts have never been the place to really achieve justice in China. The Chinese government, ever since 2015, they jailed five feminist activists who were planning to hand out stickers about sexual harassment on subways and buses. And just for that alone, they were jailed. And that kind of began this feminist movement that has sort of been growing in spite of enormous obstacles. From a legal perspective, this is an important case, but the legal arena is not where I see the greatest significance of the Me Too movement in China. And in fact, if you look at Me Too globally, you're not seeing major legal breakthroughs. It's primarily a social movement, and it's the same kind of thing in China, but with far, far greater obstacles because so many feminist voices are being silenced on social media. There's a lot of persecution of the women who speak out about gender discrimination or sexual harassment. What's fascinating about the case of China is that this feminist movement is so resilient and it hasn't been crushed in spite of the fact that the government clearly sees feminism as a threat.
You describe it as a social movement in China. What do you mean by that? How does it express itself?
It started out as being a small number of feminist activists who were doing what they called performance art protests in the streets. And then when five of those activists were jailed in 2015, there wasn't much freedom anymore for in the street style protests. So they took their activism more to social media. So there was much more of a groundswell of new support for feminism, feminist topics, feminist discussions online. But over the last couple of years, there's been an increasing crackdown on online expression of feminist content. And so a lot of the discussions have had to move increasingly underground. But the discussions continue to percolate. So I don't see an end to that development. I think we're going to continue to see more cases in the future, even though overall the political environment is very grim for any kind of social movement.
Is the spirit of the feminist movement in China, is it shared by lots of people and it's simply the government that is kind of cracking down? Or is it a kind of movement that is meeting resistance among Chinese at large?
There is definitely a strong patriarchal tradition in China. But what you're seeing today in the last several years in particular is a really strong, aggressive crackdown coming from the Chinese government. And from the ground up, there's actually a lot of increased rights consciousness that is continuing to rise and spread, particularly among college-educated women in China. And that includes young women who leave China to go and study or work abroad, say in the United States. So now there's a kind of a growing feminist diaspora from China, and some of the feminist activists who've left China continue to communicate with their friends in China. And so that's really helped to kind of keep the movement going. So I think that this is a phenomenon that is going to continue to grow in strength.
Leyte Hong Fincher is the author of Betraying Big Brother, about feminism in China. She's been speaking to us from New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all from us today, but we're always online at theworld.org. Our program comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills, back with you tomorrow with more stories from around the world and another spin of the globe.